111. At 11:15 on that momentous night, the storm breathed its last gasp. A tremendous cold gust of wind swept down on the castle. It ran in excess of 100 miles an hour. It tore the thinning clouds overhead apart like the swipe of a great hand. Cold, watery moonlight shone through. In the third eastern alley was a squat stone tower called the Church of the Great Gods. It had stood there since time out of mind. Many people worshipped there, but it was empty now. A good thing, too. The tower was not very tall, nowhere near the height of the needle, but it nevertheless stood high above the neighboring buildings in the third eastern alley, and all day long it had been punished by the unbroken force of the storm wind. This final gust was too much for it. The top 30 feet, all stone, simply blew off as a hat might fly off a scarecrow in a high gale. Part landed in the alley, part hit the neighboring buildings. There was a tremendous crash. Most of the populace of the castle keep, wearied by the excitement of the storm and already sleeping deeply, took no mind of the fall of the Church of the Great Gods, although they would wonder greatly over the snow-covered wreckage in the morning. Most simply muttered, turned over, and went back to sleep. Some guards of the watch, those not too drunk to care, heard it, of course, and ran to see what had happened. Other than by these few, the fall of the tower went mostly unremarked when it happened, but there were a few others who heard it, and by now you know them all. Ben, Dennis, and Naomi, who were getting ready for their attempt to rescue the rightful king, heard it in the napkin storeroom and looked around at each other with wide eyes. "Never mind," Ben said after a moment. "I don't know what it was, but it doesn't matter. Let's get on with it." Beeson and the lesser warders, all of them drunk, didn't hear the Church of the Great Gods fall down, but Peter did. He was sitting on the floor of his bedroom, carefully pulling his woven rope through his fingers, looking anxiously for weak points. He raised his head at the snow-muted thunder of falling stones and went rapidly to the window. He could see nothing. Whatever had fallen was on the needle's far side. After several considering moments, he went back to his rope. Midnight was close now, and he had come to much the same conclusion as his friend Ben. It didn't matter. The dice had been thrown. Now he must go on. Deep in the darkness of the secret passage, Thomas heard the muffled thunder thud of the falling tower and woke up. He heard the muffled barking of dogs below him and realized in horror where he was. And one other who had been sleeping lightly and dreaming troubled dreams awoke at the fall of the tower. He woke even though he was deep in the bowels of the castle.
"Disaster!"
one of the parrot's two heads screamed.
"Fire, flood, and escape!"
the other screamed. Flag had awakened. I have told you that evil is sometimes strangely blind, and so it is. Sometimes evil is lulled with no reason and sleeps. But now Flag had awakened. 112. Flag had come back from his trip into the north with a bit of a fever, a heavy cold, and a troubled mind. Something wrong, something wrong. The very stones of the castle seemed to whisper it to him, but Flag was damned if he knew what it was. All he knew for sure was that unknown something wrong had sharp teeth. It felt like a ferret running around in his brain, taking a bite here and a bite there. He knew exactly when that animal had begun to run and gnaw, while he was coming back from the fruitless expedition in search of the rebels, because the rebels should have been there. They hadn't been, and Flag hated to be fooled. Worse, he hated feeling that he might have made a mistake. If he had made a mistake about where the rebels were to be found, then perhaps he had made mistakes about other things. What other things? He didn't know. But his dreams were bad. That small, bad-tempered animal ran around in his head, worrying him, insisting that he had forgotten things, that other things were going on behind his back. It raced, it gnawed, it ruined his sleep. Flag had medicines that would rid him of his cold, but none that would touch that growing ferret in his brain. What could possibly be wrong? He asked himself this question over and over again, and in truth it seemed, on the surface at least, that nothing could be. For many centuries, the old dark chaos inside him had hated the love and light and order of Delane, and he had worked hard to destroy all that, to knock it down as that last cold gust of storm had knocked down the Church of the Great Gods. Always something had interfered with his plans, a Kyla the Good, a Sasha, someone, something. But now he saw no possible interference, no matter where he looked. Thomas was totally his creature. If Flagg had told him to step off the highest parapet of the castle, the fool would want to know only at which o'clock he should do it. The farmers were groaning under the weight of the killing taxes Flagg had persuaded Thomas to impose. Yosef had told Peter there was a breaking strain on people as well as on ropes and chains, and so there is. The farmers and the merchants of Delane had nearly reached theirs. The rope by which the great blocks of taxes are attached to any citizenry is simple loyalty. Loyalty to king, to country, to government. Flagg knew that if he made the tax blocks big enough, all the ropes would snap and the stupid oxen, for that was really how he saw the people of Delane, would stampede, knocking down everything in their path. The first of the oxen had already broken free and had gathered in the north. They called themselves exiles now, but Flagg knew they would call themselves rebels soon enough. Pena had been driven away, and Peter was locked in the needle. So what could be wrong? Nothing! Damn it, nothing! But the ferret ran and squirmed and gnawed and twisted. Many times over the last 3 or 4 weeks he had awakened in a cold sweat, not because of his recurring fever, but because he had had some horrible dream. What was the substance of this dream? He could never remember. He only knew that he woke from it with his left hand pressed to his left eye, as if he had been wounded there, and that eye would burn, although he could find nothing wrong with it. 113. On this night, Flagg awoke with his dream fresh in his mind because he was awakened before it was over. It was, of course, the fall of the Church of the Great Gods which woke him.
Huh?
Flagg cried, sitting bolt upright in his chair. His eyes were wide and staring, his white cheeks damp and shiny with sweat.
Disaster!
One of the parrot's heads screamed.
Fire! Flood! And escape!
The other screamed. Escape, Flagg thought. Yes, that's what's been on my mind all this time, and that's what's been gnawing at me. He looked down at his hands and saw that they were trembling. This infuriated him, and he sprang out of his chair.
He means to escape,
he muttered, running his hands through his hair.
He means to try, anyway. But how? How? What's his plan? Who helped him? They'll pay with their heads, I promise that. And they won't come off all in one chop. No, they'll come off an inch, a half inch, a quarter inch at a time. They'll be driven insane with the agony long before they die.
Insane!
One of the parrot heads shrieked.
Agony!
The other shrieked back.
Will you shut up and let me think?
Flagg howled. He seized a jar filled with murky brown fluid from a nearby table and threw it at the parrot's cage. It struck and shattered. There was a flash of bright, heatless light. The parrot's two heads squawked in terror. It fell off its perch and lay stunned at the bottom of its cage until morning. Flagg began to pace rapidly back and forth. His teeth were bared. His hands worked together restlessly, the fingers of one warring with the fingers of the other. His boots struck up greenish sparks from the nitre-caked stones of his laboratory floor. These sparks smelled like summer lightning. How? When? Who helped? He could not remember. Already the dream was fading, but...
I have to know,
he whispered.
I have to know.
Because it would be soon. He sensed that much. It would be very... very soon. He found his keyring and opened the bottom drawer of his desk. He took out a box made of finely carved ironwood, opened it, and drew out a leather bag. He opened the bag's drawstring top and carefully took out a chunk of rock that seemed to glow with its own inner light. This rock was as milky as an old man's blind eye. It looked like a piece of soapstone, but was in fact a crystal. Flagg's magic crystal. He circled his room, turning down the lamps and capping the candles. Soon his apartment was in absolute darkness. Dark or not, Flagg returned to his desk with quick confidence, passing easily around objects that you or I would have barked our shins on or fallen over. The dark was nothing to the king's magician. He liked the dark, and he could see in it like a cat. He sat down and touched the stone. He slipped his palms down its sides, feeling its ragged edges and angles.
"Show me,"
he murmured.
"This is my command."
At first, nothing. Then, little by little, the crystal began to glow from within. There was only a tiny light at first, diffuse and pallid. Flagg touched the crystal again, this time with the tips of his fingers. It had grown warm.
"Show me, Peter. This is my command. Show me the whelp that dares put himself in my way, and show me what he plans to do."
The light grew brighter, brighter, brighter. Eyes glittering, cruel, thin lips parted to show his teeth. Flagg bent over his crystal. Now Peter, Ben, Dennis, and Naomi would have recognized their dream, and they would have recognized the glow which lit the magician's face, the glow which was not a candle. The crystal's milky cast suddenly disappeared, drawing into the brightening glow. Now Flagg could see into its heart. His eyes widened, then narrowed in bewilderment. It was Sasha, very pregnant, sitting at a little boy's bed. The little boy was holding a slate. On it were written two words, God and dog. Impatiently, Flagg passed his hands over the crystal, which now gave off waves of heat.
"Show me what I need to know. This is my command."
The crystal cleared again. It was Peter, playing with his dead mother's dollhouse, pretending the house and the family inside were being attacked by Indians, or dragons, or some foolish thing. The old king stood in the corner, watching his son, wanting to join in.
"Bah!"
Flagg cried, waving his hands over the crystal again.
"Why do you show me these old, meaningless stories? I need to know how he plans to escape, and when. Now show me. This is my command."
The crystal had grown hotter and hotter. If he did not allow it to go dark soon, it would split apart forever, Flagg knew, and magic crystals were not easy to come by. It had taken 30 years of searching to find this one, but he would see it broken into a billion pieces before he gave up.
"This is my command,"
he repeated again, and for the third time, the milkiness of the crystal drew inward. Flagg bent over it until its heat made his eyes water and gush tears. He slitted them, and then, in spite of the heat, they flew open wide in shock and fury. It was Peter. Peter was slowly descending the side of the needle. Surely this was some treacherous magic, because, although he was making hand-over-hand motions, there was no rope to be seen. Or was there? Flagg waved a hand in front of his face, dissipating the heat for a moment. A rope? Not exactly, but there was something. Something as gossamer as a strand of spiderweb, and yet it bore his weight.
"Peter."
Flagg breathed, and at the sound of his voice, the tiny figure looked around. Flagg blew on the crystal, and its bright, wavering light went out. He saw its afterglow in front of his eyes as he sat in the dark. Peter. Escaping. When? It had been night in the crystal, and Flagg had seen errant, gritty sheaves of snow blowing past the tiny figure, working its way down the rounded wall. Was it to be later tonight? Tomorrow night? Sometime next week, or... Flagg pushed back from his desk and stood up with a lurch, his eyes filled with fire as he looked around his dark and stinking basement rooms. Or had it happened already?
"Enough,"
he breathed.
"By all the gods that ever were and ever will be, this is enough."
He strode across the darkened room and seized a huge weapon that hung on the wall. It was clumsy, but he held it with ease and familiarity. Familiar with it? Yes, of course he was. He had swung it many times when he had lived here and done business as Bill Hinch, the most feared executioner Delane had ever known. This terrible blade had bitten through hundreds of necks. Above the blades, which were of twice-forged Anduin steel, was Flag's own modification, a spiked iron ball. Each spike had been tipped with poison.
Enough!
Flag screamed again in a fury of rage and frustration and fear. The two-headed parrot, even in the depths of its unconsciousness, moaned at that sound. Flag pulled his cloak from the hook by the door, swept it over his shoulders, and fastened the clasp, a hammered silver scarab beetle at his throat. It was enough. This time his plans would not be thwarted, certainly not by one hateful boy. Roland was dead, Pena unbenched, the nobles driven into exile. There was no one to raise an outcry over one dead prince, especially one who had murdered his own father. If you have not escaped, my fine prince, you never will, and something tells me you're still in the coop. But part of you will leave tonight, I promise you that. That part I intend to carry out by the hair. As he strode down the corridor toward the dungeon gate, Flag began to laugh, a sound which would have given a stone statue bad dreams. 114. Flag's intuition was right. Peter had finished going over his rope of twisted linen fibers, but he was still in his tower room, awaiting the crier's announcement of midnight, when Flag burst out of the dungeon gate and began to cross the Plaza of the Needle. The Church of the Great Gods had fallen at 11:15. It was 12:15 when the crystal showed Flag what he wanted to know. And perhaps you'll agree with my idea that it tried to show him the truth in two other ways at first, and when Flag started across the plaza, it was still lacking 10 minutes of midnight. The dungeon gate was on the northeast side of the Needle. On the southwest side was a little castle entrance known as the Peddler's Gate. A straight diagonal line could have been drawn between the dungeon gate and the Peddler's Gate. At the exact midpoint of that line was the Needle itself, of course. At almost the same time that Flag came out of the dungeon gate, Ben, Naomi, Dennis, and Frisky came out of the Peddler's Gate. They approached each other without knowing it. The Needle was between them, but the wind had dropped, and Ben's party should have heard the clang rasp of Flag's boot heels against the cobbles. Flag should have heard the faint squeak of an ungreased wheel, but all of them, including Frisky, who was back to her old job of pulling again, were lost in their own thoughts. Ben and his party reached the Needle first. "Now," Ben began, and at that moment, from the other side, less than 40 paces around the outside perimeter from where they now stood, Flag began to hammer on the triple-bolted warder's door.
"Open!"
Flag screamed.
"Open in the name of the king!"
"What?"
Dennis began, and then Naomi clamped a hand like steel over his mouth and looked at Ben with frightened eyes. 115. The voice came spiraling up to Peter on the cold post-storm air. It was faint, that voice, but perfectly clear.
"Open in the name of the king!"
"Open in the name of hell, you mean," Peter thought. The good, brave boy had become a good, brave man. But when he heard that hoarse voice and remembered that narrow, white face and those reddish eyes, always shadowed by the hood of his robe, Peter's bones turned to ice and his stomach to fire. His mouth went as dry as a wood chip. His tongue stuck to the roof of his mouth. His hair stood on end. If someone has ever told you that being good and being brave means you will never be afraid, what that someone told you is not so. At that moment, Peter had never been so afraid in his whole life.
"It's Flag, and he's come for me."
Peter got up, and for a moment he thought he was going to simply fall over as his legs buckled under him. Doom was down there, hammering at the warder's door to be let in.
"Open up! On your feet, you lousy, drunken buggers! Beeson, you son of a sot!"
"Don't hurry," Peter told himself. "If you hurry, you'll make a mistake and do his work for him. No one's come to let him in yet. Beeson's drunk. He was tiddly at supper and probably paralyzed by the time he got to bed. Flag hasn't a key or he wouldn't be wasting time knocking. So, one step at a time, just as you planned it. He's got to get in and then climb those stairs, all 300 of them. You may beat him yet." He went into his bedroom and pulled out the rough iron cotter pins that held the crude bed frame together. The bed collapsed. Peter grabbed one of the iron sidebars and carried it back into the sitting room.
He had measured this bar carefully and knew it was wider than his window, and while its outer surface was rusted, he thought it was strong yet through the middle.
It had better be, he thought. It would be a bitter joke indeed if my rope held but my anchor broke.
He looked out briefly. He could see no one now, but he had observed three figures crossing the plaza toward the needle shortly before Flag's wild pounding had begun. Dennis had recruited friends then. Had one of them been Ben? Peter hoped so, but did not dare to really believe it. Who was the third, and why the wagon? They were questions he had no time for now.
Oh, you dogs! Open this door! Open it in the king's name! Open it in the name of Flag! Open the door! Open!
In the stillness of almost midnight, Peter heard the rattle thud of the wrist-thick iron bolts far below being drawn back. He supposed the door opened, but he didn't hear that. Silence. And then a gurgling, choked scream. 116. The unfortunate lesser warder who finally answered Flag's summons lived less than 4 seconds after drawing the third bolt on the warder's door. He caught a nightmare glimpse of a white face, glaring red eyes, and a black cloak that blew backward in the dying breeze like the wings of a raven. He screamed. Then the air was filled with a dry whooshing sound. The lesser warder, who was still half drunk, looked up just as Flag's battle axe split his head in two.
Next time someone knocks in the name of the king, bestir yourselves and you won't have a mess to clean up in the morning!
Flag bellowed. Then, laughing wildly, he kicked aside the body and strode up the corridor toward the stairs. Things were still all right. He had awakened to the danger in time. He knew it. He felt it. He opened a door on the right and stepped into the main corridor leading away from the courtroom where Anders Pena had once dispensed justice. At the end of that corridor, the stairs began. He looked up, grinning his dreadful shark-like grin.
"Here I come, Peter!"
he cried happily, his voice echoing and rebounding, spiraling up and up and up to where Peter stood preparing to tie his thin rope to the bar he had taken from the bed.
"Here I come, dear Peter, to do what I should have done a long, long time ago!"
Flag's grin broadened, and now he looked terrible indeed. He looked like a demon which might have climbed lately from some reeking pit in the earth. He raised the executioner's axe. Drops of the slain warder's blood fell onto his face and ran down his cheeks like tears.
"Here I come, dear Peter, to chop off your head!"
Flag screamed and began to run up the stairs. 1, 3, 6, 10. 117. Peter's shaking hands went wrong somehow. A knot he had made easily 1,000 times before now fell apart and he had to start over again.
"Don't let him scare you."
That was idiotic. He was scared, all right. Scared green. Thomas would have been astounded to know that Peter had always been frightened of Flag. Peter had just hid it better.
"If he's going to kill you, make him do it. Don't do it for him."
The thought came from inside his own head, but it sounded like his mother's voice. Peter's hand steadied a bit, and he began to knot the end of his rope to his anchor again. 118.
"I'll carry your head on my saddle horn for 1,000 years!
Flag screamed, up and up, around and around.
"Oh, what a pretty trophy you'll make!"
20, 30, 40. His boot heel struck green fire from the stones. His eyes glared. His grin was poison.
"Here I come, Peter!"
Seventy, 230 steps to go. 119. If you have ever awakened in a strange place in the middle of the night, you'll know that just to be alone in the dark can be frightening enough. Now, try to imagine waking in a secret passage, looking through concealed eye holes into the room where you saw your own father murdered. Thomas shrieked. No one heard him, unless the dogs below did, and I doubt that. They were old, deaf, and making too much noise themselves. Now, there was an idea about sleepwalking in Delane, one that has also been commonly held as the truth in our world. This idea is that if a sleepwalker wakes up before returning to his or her bed, he or she will go mad. Thomas might have heard this tale. If so, he could attest that it wasn't true at all. He'd had a bad scare, and he had screamed, but he had not come even close to going mad. In fact, his initial fright passed rather quickly, more quickly than some of you might think, and he looked back into the peepholes again. This may strike some of you as strange, but you have to remember that before the terrible night when Flagg had come with his own glass of wine after Peter left, Thomas had spent some pleasant times in this dark passageway. The pleasantness had a sour undertone of guilt, but he had also felt close to his father. Now, being back here, he felt a queer sense of nostalgia. He saw that the room had hardly changed at all. The stuffed heads were still there. Bonesy the elk, Craker the lynx, Snapper the great white bear from the north, and of course Niner the dragon, which he now looked through, with Roland's bow and the arrow foe hammer mounted above it. Bonesy, Craker, Snapper, Niner. I remember all their names, Thomas thought with some wonder. And I remember you, Dad. I wish you were alive now and that Peter was free, even if it meant no one even knew I was alive. At least I could sleep at night. Some of the furniture had been covered with white dust sheets, but most had not. The fireplace was cold and dark, but a fire had been laid. Thomas saw with mounting wonder that even his father's old robe was still there, hung in its accustomed place on the hook by the bathroom door. The fireplace was cold, but it wanted only a match struck and held to the kindling to bring it alive, roaring and warm. The room wanted only his father to do the same for it. Suddenly Thomas became aware of a strange, almost eerie desire in himself. He wanted to go into that room. He wanted to light the fire. He wanted to put on his father's robe. He wanted to drink a glass of his father's mead. He would drink it, even if it had gone bad and bitter. He thought he might be able to sleep in there. A wan, tired smile dawned on the boy's face, and he decided to do it. He wasn't even afraid of his father's ghost. He almost hoped it would come. If it did, he could tell his father something. He could tell his father he was sorry. 120.
Coming, Peter!
Flagg shrieked, grinning. He smelled like blood and doom. His eyes were deadly fire. The headsman's axe swished and whickered, and a last few drops of blood flew from the blade and splashed on the walls.
Coming now! Coming for your head!
Up and around, higher and higher, he was a devil with murder on his mind. 100. 125.